Welcome to Writers on Writing. I'm your host, Marie Stone. Today, my guest is Stephen Kent Mirisu, author of the new book, Lineage, Life and Love and Six Generations of California Wine. It's more than a book about wine. It's about time and history and leading a meaningful life. This is Stephen's first book. We had a great conversation about a lot of the choices he made to make this part memoir, part meditation on wine, a complete sensory experience. It was a delight. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I really look forward to talking to you.
So I love wine. I obviously love books. So I thought this would be sort of a no-brainer of enjoyment. But the book, of course, is so much more than that. It's this wonderful meditation on time and history and the intimate human experience of communing over all these ancient fundamental things like food and wine. It's really philosophical. It's human. I feel like it's as much memoir as it is a book about wine. And I don't know if you came away feeling that too.
I did. You know, the origin of this project spans practically 30 years. And when I first started writing, let's just say the first words that I scribbled that may have made its way into this particular book were written 25 or 30 years ago. Wow. And I didn't really know what I had necessarily when I was kind of really got serious about it. But I think one of the things that's always struck me about the business that I'm in, and my family has been doing this for 160 plus years, we're the oldest winemaking family in the country, is the not only the rituals that surround wine and wine and food, but more importantly, the ability of wine to really connect people. The ability for wine to act as not only a social lubricant, but also the glue that connects people, that is used for celebration and for celebrating new births and memorializing people that have passed. I didn't want to write a how-to on winemaking because it's been done before and done well.
Yep.
And it wasn't only a memoir. I had a really beautiful opportunity to kind of be free about what I was trying to accomplish and maybe sort of halfway through the process kind of figured out what I was really trying to accomplish. And my publisher and friend now, Paul Chutko, was really supportive of the fact of just sort of just write. Just let's just see where this thing goes. And, you know, as I said before, you know, the best friend of a writer is the delete key or the eraser. You know, editing is an extremely important part of the process. And it was a very freeing, very liberating process.
So how does somebody who's so successful and longstanding in the wine industry even decide to write a book? Because conventional wisdom is you should do anything and everything you can to avoid becoming a writer if you can possibly help it. So,
well, I think that, you know, conventional wisdom has never followed me fairly closely, I suppose. When I went off to college as a freshman at George Washington University, I went 3,000 miles away from home. And I left thinking that I wanted to be a lawyer, and I'm very happy that I disabused myself of that notion quickly, came under sort of the aegis and the thrall of a couple of really great literature professors. I've always read, always kind of scribbled, and realized that the written word was something that is extraordinarily important to me, extraordinarily important in its ability to salve emotional wounds, ability to create new insights, open new doors, new beautiful vistas, and new horrors. All of the things that I think help a person to live a full emotional life. Full means good and bad. I considered myself a student. Well, I was a student of literature. I have a master's in literature from NYU ultimately, and wanted to teach college literature, write books. I was, you know, one of those young people, 22 or 23, who thought he had to be the next F. Scott Fitzgerald, or at least wanted to be the next F. Scott Fitzgerald. And that didn't turn out happily, I suppose, and inevitably the way that I thought it might. But writing was foremost in my mind when I was in graduate school. And when I was at NYU running up and down the, you know, the one subway line on the west side of Manhattan, I kind of envisioned that the greatest thing in my life would be to see somebody across the subway train reading my book. So I actually thought of myself as a student of literature and as a potential writer before I got back into the wine business. Worked at the winery as a, my family winery as a kid in San Jose, California, and left high school telling my dad, I'm never going to get involved in this business. Lo and behold, you know, 20 years later or whatever it was, I couldn't be more happy and more emotionally satisfied by being able to do the two things I love most, vocationally anyway, which is to make wine and to put hopefully coherent sentences on paper.
And it's interesting to think about if you didn't have that path back to winemaking, if that, you know, if winemaking was always the plan and you just followed that and maybe you got your degree in winemaking from SLO or whatever you would have done, you might not have brought the depth and complexity and appreciation for it that you had through this lens of literature, right? I mean, it seems like it just gave you an appreciation for what you were doing that had this texture that you wouldn't otherwise had if you were just in it for the chemistry and science of wine.
That's a great point. I think you're right. You know, lived experience gives people a sense of context. And lived experience in all different fields. There are very few longstanding wine families in the wine business in California. There are, you know, the famous names Mondavi, both sides of the Mondavi family. There are the Wente family here in Livermore, where I am. The Mirasu family, the oldest in the U.S. in terms of just generationally making wine. But most people who come into the wine business, especially in Napa, where you get higher end experiences, higher end buildings, higher end money. Most of those folks have come in doing something else. They're attracted to the winemaking lifestyle. They're attracted to what wine means from a prestige standpoint and what it means in terms of money and that sort of thing. I had the great good fortune to grow up in a farming family. And that's what we really are. We're farmers. We've been farming California land, trying to bring something beautiful from unruly nature for seven generations with my son for 167 years now. And that gives you a different context about the wine business. Coming to wine also with a love, a passion for words, a passion for beautifully crafted sentences and books, and sort of being a romantic at heart, I suppose, gives me a vehicle for looking at the winemaking process a little bit different than maybe the average winemaker. It gives me an opportunity to sort of focus on the aesthetic side of things in a way that's a little bit different than just the technical side. And it's a great marriage of the technical side that is part of our winemaking process, but also just the idea of how beautiful wine is and how it can emotionally connect if you're making really great wine, which is what we are attempting to do every year. So my experience with wine, I think, because of my love of books and because of my experience on the literary side of my life, adds a richness and fullness to my winemaking experience, I think, is different than most winemakers.
There's some point in here where you say, and don't ask me to find it, but you say something about winemaking is another way to tell a story. You know, there are a lot of ways to tell a story. Yeah. And I thought that was so beautiful. You know, I think that's right. It's another medium of storytelling, and there's such a rich history and tradition of it. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I imagine, was there not just a ton of pressure for you to follow in your family's footsteps, or were there enough brothers to absorb the family pressure?
Well, it's interesting. There really wasn't any pressure. When I went off to college in 82, my father, I think, was at that time kind of contemplating getting out of the family business. He was the fifth generation of the family in the business, and he was the VP of sales for the company. So he was running around the country trying to sell wine, trying to bring the Mirasu name to the far-flung corners of the U.S., I think that he was getting tired of sort of the internecine conflicts that existed on the two sides of the family, the fourth generation, two brothers. So cousins on one side, my father and his brother-in-law on the other. He had different aspirations for the kind of quality of wine that he wanted to produce. And because of the fact that my folks were divorced when I was 8 or 9 years old and I didn't live with my father, there had been, and probably still is, I'm sure, a gap there in our relationship that didn't allow for him to imagine me wanting to pursue that career. Mm-hmm. I did, as it turns out, I did try on the sales end prior to getting in on the production side of things. And I, without the ability to get in on the production side of things, none of this would have happened, because there's nothing more necessary than selling the thing that you're making in all industries. But for me, it's the least compelling part of the business. The most compelling part is being able to make something beautiful and being able to make something that connects emotionally to people, that adds richness and joy to their lives on a daily basis. And only on the production side, really, do you experience that, I think. And we kind of made a point earlier about the sort of interconnection, the ability for words on paper and wine in a glass to tell a story about time, about a season, about a life, about a set of aspirations. Wine and writing certainly do that. The pressure that I feel now is strictly pressure brought on myself and my winemaking team to make the best wine in the world, which is what our aspiration is, to sort of wring the most we can from the soils that we have and from the farming that we do and from our sense of imagination about what's possible.
It kind of occurs to me that we've been talking around the book, but we haven't really fantastically introduced the book. So I guess we should do that, because it's a book far more about, much bigger than wine. Maybe you can take us into it and, you know, give us a feel of the scope of what the book covers and how it came to be.
Lineage covers a family line. Lineage being a name for one of our wine brands. It's a single wine, a Bordeaux blend, our highest end wine. And it was a name that my late wife came up with. And thankfully enough, I had a much worse name for the brand than we ultimately selected. The connection between generations is something that is enthralling for me, and in a very specific way. And I explore the idea of the fact that I do certain things at certain times of the year that are very specific to the wine business, and that my great-great-great-grandfather was doing the same thing 160 years ago. And that in some ways, that connection, that sort of molecular DNA genetic connection, makes us the same person in a strange way at various times of the year. The book is also an exploration of what it means to devote oneself to an aesthetic life, to devote oneself to the idea of making beautiful things, and to live a life of the senses. Every day when we're in the winery, every day when I have a glass of wine in front of me, I'm delving deeply into what that wine means to me from a taste standpoint, from an aromatic standpoint, how all of those things are cohesive or not, how they are beautiful or not. It's also an exploration of family, of land, of vineyards, and what it means to be in a vineyard in the middle of the night right before harvest starts, what it means to be in a winery in the cold of winter when you're putting your wines away. It's also an exploration of what it means to be in the hospitality, larger hospitality industry, and what it means to devote oneself to bringing pleasure to people, to trying to help people sort of slough off the daily cares to the extent that we can. The fact that COVID is happening now, and really last year, 2020, was even more problematic for people, I think, from this perspective anyway, is that, you know, restaurants, wineries are sort of part of the true north of civilization in a way. It's where people can go to connect with each other and where people go to be taken care of. And our hospitality mission, my personal hospitality ethos, is trying to take care of people, trying to add joy, trying to add richness to their lives. All of these themes are part of Lineage, the book. And it you know, kind of came about through an interesting, you know, I was writing, it ended up being about a 15,000 word manuscript at that time, sort of a year and a half ago or what, about. And I sent it to my dad, as we sort of periodically talk about the family history, and I wanted him to read this thing. And I sent it to him, and he ended up sending it off to a couple of other people, one of whom ended up being my editor and the owner, publisher of Valdegrasse Press, published my book. And he sent an email off to me, and out of the blue, I didn't know who he was, but he said, you know, I have this small press in Napa. If you finish this thing, I would love to publish it. And that was kind of this wow moment for me, because I had probably given up on the idea sort of 30 years after graduate school that was going to happen for me. I was immersed in the business and wonderfully immersed in the winery. But I realized that once I dove into the project and started writing every night and erasing and writing and erasing and writing, that I was living a more full life, that I really did want this thing, that I had submerged it, that other things had subsumed this desire for me, that this earlier goal. But it dawned on me again that this was a very similar way of telling stories and adding richness to people's lives that the wine business allows. That's kind of how it sort of started and what the project means to me.
It's really interesting to me to think about the time this book came out, because I feel like a lot of people, especially coming off of last year, are really looking for more meaningful ways to live their life and more ways to connect with each other in this increasingly disconnected world and this technology saturated world. And so sitting with this book for the last days gave me this incredible appreciation for another way to be and another way to for us to kind of find our way back to something important that it feels like we've lost. And I know the bulk of this book sounds like it was written during 2020 and during this isolated time. So I was wondering if you could kind of talk about how you feel, if you hadn't written this in the isolation of 2020, if it would be this reflective or philosophical about life's meaning and kind of how the impinging world may have played a role in how this came about.
That's a great question. I don't think it would have. I think that there were certain large seismic events in my life and my family's life over the last 5 years. Yeah. The most dramatic being the death of my wife. She was a school teacher. We had finally had the opportunity, once all of our kids were off into college or off in their professional lives, to move to Livermore from San Jose, so about 30 miles north of where the family had grown up, so that June could become part of the business and be more intimately involved in what you know her husband was doing and what his progenitors had been doing for 160 years. And right as we were contemplating that move and moving and about to move forward, she was diagnosed with a form of brain cancer that has no long-term survival rate. So we knew that the next period of time was going to be an exercise in quality of life, that we weren't looking for a cure because none exists at this point. We were looking to try to live a life that would add as much joy for her as possible. And after about a year of being in this incredible black hole, we had met as freshmen in college. We were destined to be together for our entire lives. And we were, unfortunately, it was just her entire life. And it was way too short. That was a lesson for me in 2016 after she died. The realization really hit it full force. And it was a lesson that was the cost of which was way too expensive, way too dear, that we get one shot at this. We get one shot to make of our lives something meaningful, something valuable, something that it's going to allow us to live the most full life we possibly can, to become the apotheosis of ourselves or our vision of what it is that we're able to do, to make, how we're going to affect people's lives. COVID reinforced that idea, the isolation aspects of it, the loss of family members, the loss of life just in a general way, the idea that that in any moment, something can happen that will end things. That precipitousness is scary. And it was a great lesson to me as I was writing the book. And as I reread it now, you know, a year and a half later, there are passages in it that sort of presaged additional changes in my life that I hadn't realized that I was writing about certain things that have come to pass in a way that reinforced this idea for me that it's absolutely necessary for people to be living their life to the fullest without that sense of urgency, or at least that kind of underlying and immediate sense that today is all that you really have. I think people don't live the fullest life that they can.
And your descriptions of it were so poetic. I don't know if the last 5 years have given you even a deeper appreciation for language and how language works. But the, yeah, or maybe, I guess that poetic tone to your voice and the voice of the book would always be there, because I don't think you can manufacture that. But yeah, it's really beautiful.
Certain, thank you. I approach language in a certain way. There's certain authors of that I've read, especially when I was in school, that have always appealed to me from a style standpoint. And I think that I write a lot like I speak, not with, with zero economy. I try to have the word be the right word, and connotation is extraordinarily important from just from the standpoint of being able to express what it is you're really trying to express. I don't know that the last 5 years haven't deepened that understanding for me, or that desire to communicate in a way that's both clear and as exact as possible. But I think that the last 5 years has certainly maybe made the words and made the structure and the like a little weightier, at least emotionally weightier.
Who are the influences that you keep drawing from 30 years later after grad school of 40?
Yeah, I wrote my master's thesis on Faulkner. Thomas Wolfe is an author that I appreciate. The Look Homeward, Angel Thomas Wolfe. I've always appreciated Hemingway, but he writes in a style that's almost diametrically opposed to the way I write. Willa Cather was an early influence when I first started graduate school. But I like being able to try to build within sentences and within paragraphs up to a crescendo as frequently as possible, emotional crescendo. I think that there are certain things I don't do particularly well from a writing standpoint yet. I think it's improving, but I do love what nature looks like. I do love what specific things feel like and taste like and seem like. And I've spent a lot of time and effort trying to put people in a place. Like, when the book opens, you open up with me in the middle of a vineyard at midnight before harvest starts. And we talk about the temperature and the stars in the night sky, and the fact that this silence is going to be destroyed in a way by the harvesting equipment that's going to be coming through in the next hour. I hope, and I've gotten some nice feedback from people, that they feel as if they were there with me. Yeah. And that's, I think, something that I've strived to do well.
Yeah, your descriptions of landscape and food and, obviously wine, but your sensual descriptions of place and stuff, food, are unbelievable. Yeah,
thank you very much.
And I saw Faulkner's name in the book, so yeah, you give little nods to yes. your elders there. That's indeed. Great. My guest this morning is Stephen Kent Mirisu. The book is Lineage, Life and Love, and Six Generations in California Wine. You're listening to Writers on Writing. So let's break down the book in terms of structure, because you started with these 15,000 words, and then knowing that what a gift to have somebody say, I'm going to publish this thing you haven't written yet. And in a new writer's life, that's just, gold.
Absolutely.
So you have these 15,000 words, and at what point did you know you had, enough for 80,000 words or whatever it turned out to be?
It didn't take a long time, I don't think, to realize that there was material there. That was the first hard part for me. I can remember being, a graduate student and realizing at that moment, when I was 22 or 23, that I didn't have a novel in me at that point in time, that I wasn't, I'm not a particularly organized person, and I don't write in a particularly organized way at this point in time. I'd like to improve on that. Mm-hmm. But, I kind of created a list for myself of things that I thought were valuable, things that I thought would be interesting for readers. There was a list of wine tasks that could be purposed in an experiential way for people, sort of allowing wine lovers or people who had some interest in wine kind of behind this curtain that they don't get a chance to be behind ever, and do it in a way that was emotional. I think fundamentally, I'm an emotional person. Fundamentally, I write in an emotional way. There were certainly, as part of the sort of memoir-esque sections of the book, there were obvious experiences like the death of my wife that I needed to explore. The move from California to the East Coast and then back again, certain vineyards that we work with. So I had a list of things, and I would kind of just write, and I'd write to one of the heads on kind of an outline in my mind anyway, and would just write until it seemed as if I had done enough for that particular thing. And over time, Paul Chutko was very helpful in making suggestions about structure and about moving certain sections from one place to another. I know I didn't want to write a true sort of autobiography of I was born on this day, and then on my third birthday, I did that, and my fifth birthday, I did this. That was not interesting to me. The idea of shapes, the idea of circles is prominent in this book. Lineage means a line, obviously. But for me, that line is more elliptical and more circular. It crosses 6-7 generations of the Mirasu family, but it folds on itself. And it rounds and it curlicues, and then it moves forward, it moves backwards, all at the same time. And these things, that idea was very attractive to me. And I tried to incorporate that into the structure of the book as well, so that there were interludes of technical wine part, not real heavily technical, but winemaking aspects of chapters. But then there were more emotionally charged chapters that I think ultimately, when the 80,000 words kind of came and then got edited down to 57,000 or 58,000, whatever the book actually is, I cut the fat. I cut the stuff that wasn't good enough. And I was left with, I think, a book that is structurally really interesting to read. And then it's compelling because it's not an ABC, but it's jumping around in time and jumping around in the time of a harvest, as well as the time of a life and the life of an industry and the life of a valley in terms of its history of winemaking. So I accomplished ultimately, I think, what I set out to accomplish, which was to create an emotional evocation of a life and a business idea, a wine idea, as well as how that plays in a heightened emotional way. And that was always something that kind of came a little bit naturally to me, but that I think appeals to people who want something a little richer maybe than just a typical memoir from a structural standpoint, perhaps. I always looked at this as a literary work and not as a coffee table book, although I think that my design team did an amazing job with the finished product in terms of how they incorporated photos and the like. The black and white aspect of the book I love. But it was always meant to be a literary endeavor.
Which is how it feels. Yeah, I think it's nice to be able, especially if you're perhaps new to writing and daunted by the idea of sitting down to write 80,000 words, if you approach it from this kind of, I just have to write this essay and it's going to be about this topic. I don't know if that's how you did it, but I think that is a nice way for writers who are trying to find their way into something to say, you know, we're just going to tackle these 5 pages on this topic. So it sounds like, so this is really interesting to me to have sort of this list of bullet points that you want to cover, write to those, but then find this much more evocative, circular, as you say, kind of, you know, interesting structure to it, because it has to work both diving into a chapter on its own and in the chapters in conversation with each other. So once you had all of that, do you kind of hang it around your office to see, you know, color coded? Okay, this is a lot memoir. This is some winemaking. This is some, you know, now it's time to go back to family history. Now it's time to come forward to my own life. Because it's so, the experience of reading it is so immersive all over the place. And you're right, the reader doesn't know where we're going to go next. And it just struck me that finding that balance of structure would be really complicated, and it's beautiful.
Thank you so much. I did have a big piece of white paper on my office wall with index cards. The index card was a chapter or was an idea, something I wanted to cover, something I wanted to make sure that I wrote to, so that I could complete the story, as it were. And the cards kind of moved around a little bit. Ultimately, there are certain chapters, early in the book, the chapter on my wife on June, I think it's chapter 3. It was much further in the book. It was probably mid part of the book. And Paul Chutko suggested that I bring some of these things earlier into the book to create emotional connections with the reader and, yeah, and to help cement a little bit less spontaneous feeling and allow a reader to kind of understand where they are at given times. I tried not to overdo that too much, but there were definite devices that I used to kind of keep me on track in terms of writing about the things I thought were important for this project, writing about the things that I felt were meaningful for people from a technical winemaking standpoint, as well as from emotional kind of writing about Stephen Miras's life and yeah, about the life of wine and the life of wine in the Livermore Valley. It was complicated at times, but what I may be most proud of in this process is that I was able to overcome issues with sort of when you're younger and thinking you have to compare yourself to the world's greatest writers, and it leaves you stuck and it leaves you with no sense of how to proceed. That never really entered into this project, in part because I'm a lot older now than I was then. I don't have the same kind of, I don't know what it is, competitive aspirations per se. I had a very specific thing that I wanted to write about and a specific set of things that I wanted to explore emotionally for myself, that I thought would be interesting for other people. And I was just sort of able to, you know, I'm going to write 500 words tonight. I'm going to write 1,000 words tonight. I'd put some Miles Davis on and I would just write. And I knew that I had the ability to strike it all out the following morning. And if it wasn't good enough, or if it didn't do the job that it was supposed to do, but for new writers like I am, for younger writers, it's just get stuff on paper. Give yourself an opportunity to look at something and let it evolve over time. You can always recraft things. You can always look at something and say, you know what, it didn't quite get the tone right. Or if you're writing a novel, this particular set piece doesn't follow logically the previous set piece. So let me figure out a way of connecting things better. There's no real deadline when you're first starting out. We had an idea about when we wanted to publish and that sort of thing. So there was kind of a parenthesis around the project in terms of time, but I never felt like I had to get a first draft done by a specific X date. The more I got into it and the more that I was writing, the more I could see that word count increase over time, the more excited I got, the more confident I became in what I was doing. And I just got great feedback and great emotional support from my editor and from the team and from, you know, the small set of people that I had read the book prior to its being finished. It ended up being such a emotionally satisfying experience.
Well, your point about, you know, not doing this when you're 20, 25, I love that about writing, because the older, you know, much like a fine wine, the older you get, the better it gets, right? I mean, sure, the more life experience we have, and you're right, all the competitive crap kind of falls away.
Right.
You just get to distill the essence of this is a life that's lived, and I think it's going to be interesting to other people. So, yeah.
Well, I hope so. Certainly more grist for the mill, yeah. You know, and you know, I happen, I think, to work in an inherently interesting business, doing something that people, a lot of people find to be fascinating and think about doing at some points in their life. So I get a chance to, again, my daily life is sort of attached to an emotional and romantic business, and it fits my personality well, I think. So, as does writing. And so I get a chance to now tie sort of the two major vocational strands of my life together to express myself as fully emotionally as I'm able to do at any given time. And as I do more of it, I think that there are more depths of things discovered and explored, at least from my perspective, that make it such an enthralling way of living on a daily basis.
Well, and wine gives you such a great vocabulary. You know, I love going into these very specific aspects of life that have their own language, and wine definitely has its own language, and it's very sensual, you know. I mean, just
absolutely.
Tannins and terroir, you know, all
terroir and tannin and the names of places are conjure such amazing images, the names of grapes, the names of different soil types. The things that we do, the wine world from a commercial standpoint is filled with jargon that does nothing but obscure and sort of obfuscate. And when I write notes about the wines that I'm making for people, I try never to write specifically about what a wine is supposed to taste and smell like, because that's a journey that's personal. Nobody tastes or smells the same thing the same way. And it's a journey of discovery. And wine's a magical thing. Each wine should be, it should be at the end of a journey that people willingly take and discover along the way how they feel about certain things, of certain grape type or certain style. What I do write about is, the context of that, the context of the place that the grapes came from, the context of the importance of that specific wine in a portfolio of wines or in the career of a winemaker. Again, a larger, more circular way of looking at that thing. Wine is a bottomless thing. You can never know anything, and you can never know everything about a wine. You can never know everything about all wine, obviously. And the deeper you dive, the more passionate you get, the more it opens up and the deeper you are sort of compelled to dive. And I look at that as sort of a symbol for just living an emotional life. That the more you dive into the emotional side of your life from an artistic standpoint as a writer, from the artistic and craftsmanship standpoint of a winemaker, the more resonances you find, the more connections to the aesthetic side of life you build and strengthen. And for me, that's all that I want from my life. And so I'm a really fortunate person to be able to do the, so I think, two things that really allow me to connect in that way to what I find most valuable.
I would totally butcher this, but there's a part in the book, you describe your mouth sort of like a cave with the walls of the cave and the
right,
your tongue. And I thought, you know, I'm never going to drink wine the same way again after listening to that. It's perfect. It's really great.
It's weird. It's a synesthesia of some sort. But early in my career, it just kind of came to me that that's sort of what's happening physically to me anyway, that I'm experiencing this beverage, this every wine, every, whether it's barrel sample or finished wine or what have you, in a way that highlights the structure of the wine, highlights the pieces of the wine that are most important, I think, to creating a beautiful and complete wine, whether it's, you know, acid or tannin, fruit, wood. Those four things really are kind of the pillars upon which are built beautiful wines, compelling wines, emotionally compelling, as well as just hedonistically compelling. And I've never been able to get that vision out of my head. And it's just, now it's an automatic thing for me. But the idea that I'm going on a journey, or the wine is going on a journey inside me, and that I'm able to, or only able to, look at that wine in that context is something that's valuable to me as a winemaker, because those are the physical attributes of wine that I'm looking to help shepherd into a shape, ultimately, that people will find delicious and compelling. And there are many different ways to taste. There are many different ways to evaluate if someone really wanted to be in the wine business from a professional capacity. Creating ways to strengthen sense memories, so that when you taste something blind, or you taste the first Chardonnay you ever taste, or Cabernet Franc, you get a sense of what that feels like in your mouth, what it tastes like, what it smells like. And it's really sort of a shorthand for me to kind of put that somewhere in the database of my memory, to allow me to compare the next vintage of wine, or 10 vintages down the road, to that specific wine, and hopefully do as good a job then as I, or now as I did then.
What were the hardest parts of this? Because, I mean, it strikes me that it could be hard to write about wines. You don't want to get too deep in the weeds with chemistry and all that kind of stuff, because as you've said, A, it's been done, and B, it's not the voice of this book. Obviously, the chapters about your wife were, you know, really, it's fairly fresh. I mean, it's really,
yes,
not that far in our rearview mirror.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering if there were parts of this where you got stuck and how you got yourself kind of out of it.
The chapter about my wife, I think, was the last chapter I wrote, mm-hmm. or one of the last chapters I wrote. It's early in the book in finished form. That was a chapter that I wasn't looking forward to. I'm sure that if I were in counseling, the counselor would tell me that you shouldn't be doing this, but I've been able to function and being able to kind of move forward in a way by not fixating too much about any particular part of my past. June exists you know, in me on an ongoing basis, on a daily basis, through obviously my four kids, my grandkids at this point in time, but just the spirit that she had, the idea of going back constantly to something that's painful is difficult. The idea, I'd never wanted to shirk from it, and I ultimately didn't, and I don't, because I think that that's part of what makes for an emotionally complete life. That was a hard part to write, but it was a necessary part for the story, I think. You know, it was interesting, trying to get into a daily habit early on in the process. And this would have been like, I think got an email from my publisher in September of 19, something like that. And then started digging into daily writing. And I had zero experience with that, because I would scribble, I'd write a little bit, I'd find something, I'd walk around a vineyard and find something I'd see that seemed compelling. Let me see if I can communicate that in words. But that would happen like every other year, literally, you know. Right. So if 15,000 words took me 30 years to write, the hardest part was just being able to create a habit from it. I ultimately was able to do that. Harvest is difficult. We in fact, we're pressing off our last lot of fruit as I'm speaking to you right now.
Oh, right. So yeah, right.
A little bit of Cabernet Franc is being pressed off right now, and then it'll be barreled down in a few days, and then the harvest part of our year will be over. It takes 14 hours a day, 7 days a week. There is no time during harvest, which is something I love about the business as well. So just being able to create a habit, being able to, you know, to make sure I sat down, whether I wrote 100 words or 2,000 words, there needed to be progress. And the 100 words may have been the next day deleted. It continued the momentum forward. Aside from the passages about my late wife, it wasn't difficult to write the other passages, and became easier as I did it more. You know, I understood, I became more confident in the process. I became more confident in my voice. I became more confident in the structure of the book and what it was I was trying to convey. And so it ended up, every day was just sort of more fuel, more an accretion of sort of as the words accreted, so did the confidence. And so did the idea that I actually could do this thing and could finish this thing. So there's nothing like succeeding on a daily basis to help you succeed, you know, over the course of a year and a half.
Well, now that you've done it, I hope you're going to keep doing it. Do you find that you now writing begets writing and you have more to say?
Yes, absolutely. And what the way that I one of the gifts of this process, and one of the gifts of having completed it, completed Lineage, and have it be available to people in such a beautiful way. Again, from a design standpoint, just the way the book is put together, the fonts, everything, it's just gorgeous. Yeah. A woman named Connie Wang, who is an emeritus professor of design from San Jose State, was the one who kind of helped. She's the one who created the look and feel of the book. Now I consider myself to be a winemaker and a writer. That's the way I look at my life now. And so I'm writing a book on Cabernet Franc, my favorite grape. I've also got an idea for maybe a three-part novel. I'm not exactly sure where it's headed yet, but you know, I'm, I don't know, 15,000 words into that too. So I'm attempting to write, and I write more from a business standpoint, blogs on my website and that sort of thing as well. So writing does definitely beget writing. Definitely. It's not depletion exercise. It's a multiplication exercise. You know, every time I get a chance to put a few words together and they mean something, or they sound great when you read them out loud or what have you, it just adds fuel to the fire. And so that's a really exciting part of the process too.
Yeah. Well, you've alluded to this, but the book is so beautiful. I know it's not a coffee table book. It is a literary book, but the black and white photography, the cover, there's some sort of like ribbon on here that's, you know, it's unbelievable. Iridescent ribbon over
here. Yeah, it's done beautifully. Just fantastic.
I was thinking, I'm going to plug this because, you know, maybe you're not allowed to, but this is an amazing Christmas. I mean, if you bought a bottle of one of your Lineage wines and this book, you're going to have a really good, have a really great Christmas.
Thank you for plugging it. I appreciate that. No, I definitely can. Thank you. We are making some really beautiful wines here. My winemaking team and I making some beautiful wines. We have a great hospitality staff here. We're open for tastings on the weekend. So if anyone is in the Bay Area and wants to come by and sort of see what we're doing and taste what we're doing, we'd love to share. The wine doesn't, wine's like that tree. An untasted wine or a wine that you drink by yourself is like the tree in the forest. It doesn't really exist in a way. Wine's about sharing. Wine's about sharing emotions and sharing hedonistic experiences and the like. And I would love for as many people as possible to read this book and give me feedback and let me know how it affected them. This book was written as an emotional exercise in a way, cathartic in some ways, but also in ways of hopefully being prescriptive of trying to show people how valuable it is to look at their lives in an active way and in a way that is about diving deeply into the emotional side of their lives and trying to mine as much as they possibly can each and every day. So it's meant to be a living thing. It's certainly not just a memoir. It's not just a how-to about wine. I think it's a compelling read, and I would love for people to go to Amazon or go to my website and grab a copy and let me know what they think.
Yeah. And it was really, you know, it's so hopeful because you know, as we've alluded to a lot about the loss of your wife, but you know, I don't think it gives too much away to say you've found love again. And there's that part too. And so it really had this full circle, lovely, you know, statement of hope in a time when I think a lot of us are struggling to look for that. And so, yeah, there's just layer upon layer of philosophy and literature and beauty and aesthetics and wine and food and all of it. It's a lot. You know, I have a deep love of wine, but I don't have a deep love of reading about wine generally.
Sure. Sure.
And so this was just so refreshing and so just such a feast for every sense. So I really love it. Thank you so much.
I really appreciate that. I appreciate the feedback. I don't love reading about how wine is generally written about either, because it's either score based or it's based just, you know, strictly on it tastes like, you know, citrus or it tastes like rocks or whatever. I mean, that's pretty boring after a while, because it takes out of context, removes from an overall more, I think, a central emotional context that wine occupies, and reduces it to sort of it's kind of a ledger, accounting ledger that is ultimately boring and ultimately reductive. And I've always tried to shy away from that kind of more boring, more sort of business-centric way of communicating about wine and communicating about it in a way that hopefully, you know, it touches the soul and the emotions. And so I appreciate the fact that you're reading that as well.
And we can follow you on your website. Tell us that. Yeah, so, I forgot.
StephenKentMirisu.com. So my
there you go. Name. Okay.
And I've got a blog there and a newsletter and, you know, sort of writing some longer form things as well. And there's links to my book too. But that's kind of the place where you can also get links to our wine websites too, where you can learn more about specific releases and learn more about what it is the season, the part of the season is bringing us. So you can get all that you need from a writing and wine standpoint through StephenKentMirisu.com.
And I think you've done a couple of podcasts just on the wine side of this. So if people want that, I don't know if that's not your podcast, but that's...
No, I've been a guest on a number of podcasts. I've done some podcasts, and Harvest Time and trying to get the book finished sort of stopped me. I have a podcast. I need to get back onto it because I like communicating this way. I'm a talker and it's somewhat rambling, and it's really just me talking for a few minutes about something, you know, something wine related or what have you. But there is a link to the podcast on my website as well. And there will be more episodes coming down the line.
Love it. Stephen Kent Mirisu, this was so fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Maria. I really appreciate all the support and am honored to be on your podcast. Thank you very much.
That was Stephen Kent Mirisu. The book was Lineage, Life and Love and Six Generations in California Wine. You can find this and other episodes on our websites. Barbara's is barbaradeMarcoBarrett.com. Mine is mariestone.com. Music, sound design, and editing provided by Travis Barrett. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.